from a nightclub at the end of the world. Hi, everybody. Alas, Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Yeah, that's Hamlet somewhere. Last week, I was so zoned that it didn't even dawn on me that it was Easter. So I had Dmitry Orlov all lined up, and being in the zone is exactly where I was. It's been a very intense period, but I'm stepping out of that now. So we just kind of, you know, tried to keep the rhythm and focused on what was in front of us, but every now and again it's good to stick our heads up. So I got to recalibrate a little bit, and we're back here tonight. Dmitry will be with us next week. Then after the week after that, you're going to get me, because I got a whole lot of new stuff I'm going to have to talk to you about on my own. Got to do some updates before we bring on our guest tonight and start talking about some heavy-ass stuff. It's springtime here in Sebastopol, and on this incredible 2.5 acres, we got the permaculture going, and everything is just coming to life. We got hummingbirds and bees and blossoms and sprouts, and I'm going to be getting out into that. It's time to build more on my lifeboat. It's that time of the year, and it's the season when we do that, and we have to honor the seasons and the timing, but spring just has never felt or tasted so good, and that's really cool. A lot of stuff changing, man, just a lot of stuff changing. First, let's do the Iran thing. It was so obvious at CollapseNet over the last few months. Iran is holding all the cards. And I was particularly alarmed earlier this week, maybe it was last weekend, but when Iran shut off oil to Spain, which means it holds the European economy by the jugular vein, but Iran selling oil at 0% interest, and what an amazingly revolutionary act that was. Talk about until you change the way money works, you change nothing. What have I been yapping about all these years? Compound interest, fiat currency, and fractional reserve banking. So Iran is changing the way money works. But Iran also this week really caught my attention when they announced, in effect, a trade war that goes against 30 or 60 major European companies. And that just brought back historically the perspective of World War II, when trade wars were the activity du jour in the run-up to 1939. So it was like very tense going into this P5+1 summit. I bet you most of you haven't heard hardly anything about it. 5+1 is the 5 UN permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, and with Iran talking about those nasty old nukes. And it's never been about nukes. It's about the dollar. It's about oil. And they had their meeting yesterday, and what happened was nothing. What happened was, everybody came out of the meeting, and I read 5 or 6 different takes. We have them on CollapseNet of the statements. But basically, everybody agreed to keep talking. Nothing was decided. Nothing was conceded. And everybody said how polite everybody was. Isn't that nice? Iran is definitely, absolutely now a bona fide, certified world power. And they have earned that seat. And they are behaving honorably. Somebody that tells the truth, which Iran has clearly been doing, automatically has my vote, because I have a government which can't tell the truth to save its life, and it can't live by the truth to save its life. So there's some revolutionary changes in consciousness, and the Iceland thing that Gary was talking about is kind of related to that. I saw the story, Iceland forgives mortgage debt of its population. We had it up on CollapseNet. It ran. Mish, Mike Shedlock, sent an email to somebody and said he wasn't quite sure it was true yet. But it is a part of the change of consciousness, and that's all it takes. Now, Iceland just said, I'm not going to play your infinite we don't need your stinking banks. Banks? We don't need those stinking banks. And look at how they're doing. Iceland, excuse me. And that's the kind of change of consciousness where you don't battle or fight an old paradigm. It just becomes obsolete, and nobody wants anything to do with it. And that's kind of what I see going on. I have a really good quote from a guy named Mike Krieger that I was going to read last week with Dmitry. I'm going to shorten this, but He writes, this was from a story that came on Zero Hedge, Mike Krieger Explains Central Planning for Dummies. It's we have it up on the Yellow Bar Collapse Net. So what we need to understand is that we are in one of the most dangerous phases of the crisis at this moment. The priests of fiat are being attacked from all sides. People have awoken to the Fed and how criminal and deceitful this organization is and the existential threat it poses to economic freedom and hence human liberty. The arguments against the Fed are blistering, and the only rebuttal the Fed has is to spout the same old nonsense like "we saved the world" or some trite derivative of this fallacy. They only think they saved, the only thing they saved are untalented speculators from their bad bets. What the Fed has systematically done is literally transfer all of the bad debts and bets from the banks to the taxpayer. We are living this reality today. The fact is becoming increasingly understood throughout society, hence the emergence of the Tea Party and then last year's Occupy Wall Street movement. So the thing I want my readers to really internalize is that the Fed and indeed the powers that be, which I call the powers that were now, generally are getting slaughtered in the intellectual arena and they know it. As a result, they feel cornered and will thus act increasingly aggressive to prove they are right and everybody else is wrong. As I have said many times before, the Bernanke needs to create more money, and he knows it. He is irate beyond belief that his academic theories have not worked. He is furious that he can't make the housing market come back to life. He is having a temper tantrum that people actually have the nerve to link printing trillions of dollars to the rise in commodity prices. He wants to launch QE3 this quarter, but he feels like public opinion is against him. He's right. And Obama is having his own little panic attack about gasoline prices and the election. So what's the central planner to do? Well, exactly what they've been doing as of late, lie. The more cornered they have become, the more aggressively they have acted. Watching the most powerful people on the planet fight their inevitable demise has been and will continue to be fascinating and frustrating. They will fight and fight. They will rig and rig. They will lie and lie until one day the whole thing will end seemingly overnight. They will vanish into history, disgraced and remembered for time immemorial as some of the biggest fools in world history. That was a beautiful quote, and that a lot of that's going on, man. There's just a lot of heavy changes under the way. And if, in case you haven't noticed, there's been like some major weather changes underway. 4.5 feet of hail in Texas and places in Colorado this week. A biblical drought. Biblical might be an understatement. Running from Texas through Mexico down into Central America. We see this unbelievable weather, 7,000 record sets. So there is an amazing reorganization of climate on our planet, which may be, which is, in my opinion, a combination of man-made activity, global warming, also geoengineering on a certain level, and also the universe itself just rearranging things. We have somebody on tonight, Guy McPherson, who's with us, and who knows a lot about this stuff, but he's made some really drilling statements that I want to get into. He's a professor emeritus of natural resources and ecology and evolutionary biology from the University of Arizona, and he checked out of that system. Boy, do I understand that. I did that a long time ago, too. He's got some fiery intellect working, and he came to my attention recently when I saw a videotape that we had on CollapseNet up there for you, in which he was talking about a study which said, in essence, that in order for the human race to survive, it is necessary to stop all economic activity now. And that was the flip side or another side of a dodecahedron, or, you know, that I have a side of. Which is seeing everything else collapse on many different levels. But I came to the conclusion sometime after I gave the post-petroleum human speech about a year ago that we had to take on this beast and kill it, because if we didn't take on this beast, it was going to kill us. So who's winning? Who's up? Well, I asked Guy to send me an intro for him, and I'm just going to read you what he wrote, because I think it sets him up really well. And then I'm going to ask him about that study, and then we're going to take it from there. Guy McPherson was born and raised in the heart of the Aryan Nation, small town northern Idaho. His first experience He first experienced the hair-raising incident of a rifle pointed at the back of his neck when he was 10 years old. It didn't happen to me until I was about 22. Okay. The person behind the trigger was 13. This episode was so ordinary, he bothered to tell his parents for two decades. It simply never came up. The escape from the benighted village came in the form of education, in large part because McPherson's parents were lifelong educators. To pay for his undergraduate education, which led to a degree in forestry, McPherson spent summers working on a helitack crew. Staring down a large wildfire at the age of 19, he realized some forces of nature are beyond the human ability to manage. Good observation, sometimes even comprehend. More than 10 years into a career in the academic ivory tower, McPherson began focusing his efforts on social criticism, with topics ranging from education and evolution to the twin sides of fossil fuel coin, global climate change, and to energy decline and the attendant economic consequences. His public appearances stress these two predicaments because each of them informs and impacts every aspect of life on Earth. Amen. McPherson's contemporary presentations stress the importance of individual and societal action in light of ongoing global change and energy decline. All events highlight the importance of living sustainably, a necessity driven by completion of the ongoing collapse of the industrial economy and underlain by the absence of cheap oil. McPherson's latest chapter includes abandoning his tenured position as a full professor at a major research university for ethical reasons. Amen. Love that. High five. His story is described in his memoir, Walking Away from Empire. Guy McPherson, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, man.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay. We started this off, that study that essentially said that we had to kill economic activity to survive. Can you talk about that briefly as like an opener here?
Sure. There's a physicist named Tim Garrett at the University of Utah who published this paper in the prestigious journal Climatic Change in November 2009. Now, it had been rejected by several journals before that because nobody wants to hear that. And finally, it was accepted and published about 2.5 years ago. And essentially what it says is what we all know, that energy conservation and efficiency don't really matter because of Jevons' paradox or its latest incarnation, the Brooks-Kazum postulate. And that if we don't reduce carbon emissions by 80% to 90% essentially immediately, we are committed to runaway climate change, which means extinction of our species.
So from a Cartesian standpoint, how would it be possible to achieve that kind of result, to shut off 80% to 90% of carbon emissions? What would that entail?
That would mean we would have to terminate the industrial economy as rapidly as possible. And it looks like we're headed that direction. Mm-hmm. It looks like we will be able to terminate the industrial economy, that is, stop the fuel showing up at the filling stations and the food at the grocery stores and the water coming out of the municipal taps within a relatively short period of time.
As I read your intro, it appears as though you've approached collapse intellectually from several different directions, not just from that of a climate scientist. The social part fascinated me, and I detect, like I certainly have, and I'll admit to it up front, a good deal of maybe anger or frustration in trying to deal with this. Enlighten us on that from your perspective.
Well, this is hard. I mean,
yeah.
What we're doing here is going against the cultural mainstream, and that's unbelievably challenging because we've all been fed this line about infinite growth on a finite planet, and most people don't even question it. In fact, I would say we aren't even fed that line. We are just born into captivity, to use a phrase coined by my friend Timothy Bennett, who made the movie What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire,
mm-hmm.
with his wife, Sally Erickson. Right, that's right. And it looks like we were born into captivity. I routinely say the problem is not that we're fish out of water. The problem is that we are fish in the stream, and we don't even know there's water. This whole culture tells us this astonishing series of lies about what's good for us and what's good for the culture, and we never think to question those lies because we are so immersed in the mainstream.
I have noticed. Now, I've been doing what I do since 1977, which is a long time, and that's when I stepped out, you know, and made my choice. I am aware of that. For the first 25 years of that, it seemed like nothing was changing anywhere. Now it seems like that there is an accelerated rate of awareness for what's going on, an accelerating quickening. Are you noticing that too?
Well, yes. And in fact, M. King Hubbard predicted that as his third prediction in the 1956 talk he gave as a petroleum geologist for Shell Oil Company. The first two predictions had to do with the United States and the world reaching their peak extraction of crude oil. Mm-hmm. And the third prediction was that in the wake of global peak oil, we will see considerable cultural disruption. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing that. Arab Spring, anybody? How about Occupy Wall Street?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's tremendous cultural disruption going on right now. And it's, at least in part, because of awareness of issues. I suspect it's also due in part because of an industrial economy that's going straight into the crapper. And so
that's something else that I picked up on very clearly over the last week or 10 days, which is that I'm picking up a real sense of capitulation out there, you know, that fewer phony excuses are being offered, and like, you know, there is an awareness that none of this stuff is going to be fixed, at least at this level of consciousness. And that's why the level of consciousness is so. At this point, the only thing we can change, I think, is our mind. And that's what I said in the movie Collapse. You know, it's the 100th monkey thing, but, you know, also I said, now God is on the table, and quite literally, it is. It's about time for our song. We do this nightclub thing here. We have this ambiance. And there's a song that really cried out to me that said, you want to play me this week. And it has to do with my personal sensation of changing realities around me, just different feelings of energy and a rapid sense of change in the air. But to take a break from this, so I think we're going to listen tonight to Avalanche and Earthquake, and we're all going to take a breath during the song, tune up, and come right back with Guy McPherson after this.
Follow me, avalanche.
from the New White Trash. I wrote it. That was me singing it, and wrote with Doug Lewis. And boy, that song just fit tonight. It's having a different ring to me tonight. You can find that song and 36 other originals at newwhitetrash.com, and help us out that way. That was a real appropriate song. So we're back tonight on the Lifeboat Hour on Progressive Radio Network with Guy McPherson. Guy, your website is guymcpherson.org?
GuyMcPherson.com.
.com, excuse me. Look him up. You have been on a really aggressive, it looks to me, speaking tour. What's the subject of the tour? Where are you in that? And how's it being received?
Well, my fourth speaking tour in 6 months just came to a close a couple of days ago. I was in New York State, Western Massachusetts. Previous tours were in Michigan, and the topics vary quite widely. Generally, I speak about the twin sides of the fossil fuel coin, climate change and energy decline and the economic consequences. But I speak on a pretty wide array of other topics, too. And so, for example, on this latest trip, when I spoke at State University of New York Fredonia, I was speaking to a large group, a little over 200. 33 of the students were from a Kurt Vonnegut course, and 30-some were from an environmental chemistry course. So I started by reading a few snippets from Kurt Vonnegut's memoir, A Man Without a Country, and then transitioned into addiction, fossil fuel addiction, where that takes us with respect to climate change and peak oil. And with most of my talks, all roads lead to Rome, so they all end up at some point with me discussing economic impacts of...
That was a pun, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I mean, it certainly is collapsing in spades on afterburners all around us here. But that brings up something that I've discussed a lot of the thread recently, which is the world's evolution to what I call System D, which is not illegal crimes. It's just operating outside of that system, which the whole world seems to be doing more or less spontaneously. Maybe it's as a defensive reaction. I don't know where I want to go next. Okay, so let me do this, because we have a lot to talk about, and I just want to plumb this mind. But every now and again, PRN allows me the discretion of passing the commercial break at the bottom of the hour, and I'm going to do that tonight here, and special thanks to PRN-FM for allowing me to do this once in a while. And I got to talk to you about something important, my head will be clear to talk to Guy when I get this done. I have to talk about CollapseNet. We have, if you are a member of our site, or if you're not, even if you take advantage of a lot of the free stuff that we give away there, you know that we have been delivering and performing for you like no other news and organizational site, news and information site is anywhere in the world. Gary Null's quite right that the world is fleeing, like Iceland's fleeing the banks and everything else, and people are fleeing mainstream media en masse now, and the numbers confirm this. Gary just announced on his show before we opened this that the top 10 shows from PRN-FM, which would include this one, we're right behind Gary, are going to be syndicated. That deal is coming out in May. I have no more details, but there's a big change going on. But it's horrific trying to live and function with 1 foot half in the old paradigm and 1 foot in the new. And we're suffering financially horribly at CollapseNet, because my objective has never been to make money. Had my objective been to make money, I would have charged $1,000 a year and had 1,000 members. We wouldn't have to worry about this. But we have 6,300 members, it shows, but 2,000 of those are people who have dropped out due to economic hardship, and they've written us and they've said, geez, we love it, we need it, it's plugging us into the information. We get to nurture this post-petroleum consciousness. And so we're carrying those, and we've given away about 800, maybe 1,000 to activists and people around the world. And we've had massive cyber attacks this year, had a huge one early this week, the biggest ever, but it was short-lived. Our new mechanisms that we put in place, which were pretty expensive, did work well for us throughout that. But collapse net is not a thing. Collapse net is it's me, it's Wes, it's Luis, it's Carl, it's Richard, it's Arrow, it's John, it's Rice Farmer, it's Jenna Orkin, it's Carolyn Baker, it's Jimmy, it's there are like 20, and these are all really amazing people. A lot of them are hurting. They're ICs and independent contractors, and we throw them what little, we give them what little we can, and in this environment, they're living on that, but we're not able to make ends meet. And it gets to a question of whether I get to pay the rent this month, but it got a little worse this month because of a key, hugely central man in the company who's been with us since the start was recently diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis, which is ALS. It's a cousin of Lou Gehrig's disease. It is a it is a fatal diagnosis. It is what happens is that the vertebrae in your back start to fuse from the bottom up, and when they get to a certain level, they'll shut off the nerves that run the heart. And in this climate, I don't know how to come out to you, and I can't do the Earl Scheib thing and come out and say $29.95 for this and this to get this money, and I can't think in that anymore. And what came to me this week as I was thinking about this, and the amazing people at who make CollapseNet so valuable, and you know, we got about like 25,000 visitors a day, but the lights are going on. That these are some of the 25,000 heaviest movers and shakers in the world. So I don't know how to quantify this to you to say that we need money, except for the fact that as I thought about all the people who make CollapseNet, we do this. And you know that I've been commenting on Newslinks 7 days a week for over a year and a half now. That's going to be changing for me soon because I'm called to do some other writing. But we do this because we love you. We do this out of love for the species, for the planet. And so when you think about getting out a checkbook or buying a membership or giving us a donation, which you can do by clicking on the button on the website that says support independent journalism, do it out of love, not because you can quantify the benefit that you get from it, but just put the love in the money. And we all know how that feels when you buy, when you spend some money on a very special gift for somebody you really care about. That's the only way I can sell CollapseNet to you now. And that, frankly, it's the only way I want to. We put everything we have, we put our hearts into this, and we need your help. And this dear man who makes this company run, he's a young man, wife and two kids involved, and we need to pass some of that love to him, too, because his heart's in CollapseNet. And so I needed that time tonight to do this, and I thank PRN for letting me have that that block of time. Now we're going to come back to Guy. Guy, I'm sorry for making you sit through that, but I had to get that out there tonight.
No problem.
And now I'm a little bit freer, I think, to get back to what's going on here. So we have to stop human industrial civilization, and we kind of left it. Well, that appears to be something of a fait accompli. Of course, I would rather accelerate it than decelerate it, but I think, you know, but that's there. But then comes the question, what do we do next? What would we do next? What direction is there out of this?
Well, we could go to our roots and live like we did the first 2 million years of the human experience. Mm-hmm. In a close to the land, close to our neighbors' existence, where we depended upon a few dozen people around us, and that's basically the world we knew, at least the human world. We could do what I'm doing here, which is living in agrarian anarchy. Mm-hmm. And anarchy is not chaos. It's taking responsibility for yourself and for your neighbors. And for me, it's taking responsibility for yourself and for your neighbors, human and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there are many routes. I suspect that none of them will be pursued with much vigor by most people because they are addicted to industrial civilization. So what we face in the years ahead is a series of challenges that I think will require an enormous amount of compassion and courage and creativity. That's one of the things that's very exciting to me, is to see that creativity emerge in human beings as we learn to live differently than we've been living for a long time.
I might look at it and say that part of what this change of consciousness involves, which is underway, is, for example, take Fukushima, is the realization that Fukushima is not a Japanese event. Fukushima is a human event. I see empathic connections being made between, as we read the stories about the suicides in Greece and Italy and all over Europe that are going up, an empathic connection seems to be something that might serve as like a tuning fork to get everybody on the same page.
Well, yes. I mean, what we have right now is a crisis of consciousness. That's how we're in these dire straits we're in, on so many levels. Those dire straits include human population overshoot. They include an extinction crisis that's unparalleled in planetary history. They include, of course, peak oil and the economic implications of that. And, of course, also the global climate change that threatens our own species with extinction. All of that has its roots in a crisis of consciousness. How do we live? Do we have a conscience at all?
Some of us do. That's usually we're the ones that are most unhappy or most uncomfortable. I just got an email, forgive me for this. Somebody asked me to give out the address for this CollapseNet special fund, and if you would like to help us and keep us going and send some love back our way, you can write a check, a money order, send it to CollapseNet Special Fund. That's 708 North Gravenstein Highway, Gravenstein Highway, Box 266 in Sebastopol, California. That's also up on the Support Independent Journalism button on the homepage at CollapseNet. Okay, so I heard a story a long time ago, and there was a group of scientists that had gone to Marineland, the way the story went. It might be a fable, but they were trying to study dolphins and movement in dolphins, and they were trying to figure out how it learned and to teach it new tricks. And somebody postulated that a crisis of consciousness was necessary to unleash something called creativity. And what they did was they disrupted the dolphin's environment. They fed it at the wrong times. They disrupted its sleep cycle, its everything else cycle, and got it all sideways. And the dolphin showed enormous signs of stress to where the vets were thinking the dolphin was going to have a total breakdown and die. But then suddenly the dolphin leapt out of the pool and performed like four or five new maneuvers that became the basis of the SeaWorld show. And the way that was explained to me is that at the level of consciousness that you're at for a given situation, a crisis being defined as a state of condition, a state of affairs which is unacceptable and for which there are no solutions. And I think the answer is that at the level of consciousness that you're at, there are no solutions. But yet when I hear you lecture, and I'll show up and let you talk after this, I hear you say very strongly things like we have to hold on to hope, because if we otherwise it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think there's more to that. Is there?
Well, I think we have to use action. And I, Derek Jensen and I disagree on the definition of hope. Even if you think that hope is hopeless, then action is the antidote to despair. And what that means is we have to look at the world as it is, not as we want it to be. Mm-hmm. That's going to require some pretty significant changes in the psyche of most people in the industrialized world.
Mm-hmm. And yet, those changes of consciousness are accessible. I see evidence of it happening at some increasing speed. The question is whether it will be too soon, too late, or whatever, to make a difference.
Well, sure. I mean, I was born into captivity, too. You know, all I ever experienced was economic growth, and I was a lifelong academic. When I started this project, I could barely distinguish between a screwdriver and a zucchini. It tells you all you need to know about how well I can build things and how well I can grow things. It's just that we are in a different place than we've ever been, and we're going to have to think differently than we've ever thought before. Will it be enough to save our species and the tens of thousands of others we're dragging into the abyss with us? Well, I hope so, but that hope is founded in love for other humans, including future generations, and also for the other species with which we share the planet. But we must act, and we must act very, very quickly to terminate this omnicidal beast that is making us crazy and making us sick and killing us.
We're down to about the last 15 minutes of the show. If you'd like to ask Guy McPherson a question tonight, you can call in at 1-888-874-4888. Guy, there have been mass extinctions, as I recall, even a complete extinction or near complete extinction on the planet before, and yet life returned. Even if we have a total nuclear screw-up, which we're racing towards, I mean, Fukushima is an absolute disaster, and all life becomes extinct, what does that say about the possibility for life continuing? Do you think we can kill everything on the planet successfully? It seems to be what we want to do.
It does seem to be what we want to do, and obviously I'm not a fan. And we've never been there before either. This is the sixth great extinction event. The previous ones drove 50 to 90% of the species on the planet to extinction. We only once in the history of this planet have we started from scratch, started from no life and ended up with life. That's in 4.6 billion years on this planet. I'm hoping we don't need to terminate all life and have to start over from scratch.
Well, but that certainly seems to be where we're going. I mean, from a climatological standpoint alone. But Fukushima is a separate issue, which I think kind of, we have a call, we'll get to him in a second, fits into this, because Fukushima is certainly not soluble by Japan alone. It's out of control. The radiation at 2 is too high. They don't even have machines that can function. They got to design the machines. That if we're all not to go down as a result of Fukushima, then the whole world would need to reach a place of realizing that every human being on the planet needs to solve the problem in Japan, or we're all going to die. Let me hold you with that. Frank in California is on the line. Are you there, Frank?
Hi, Mike, you there?
Yeah.
Hi, great work, by the way. I've been a member a long time, and just rock on. Great work.
Thank you.
I want to ask the guest why he left academia for ethical reasons. I'm an academic here in San Jose, and I'm thinking the same thing. I just want to hear his thoughts on, you know, what his thought process was leading up to his decision.
Great question.
And I can take that off the air, okay?
Great question. Thank you. Go, Guy.
Well, I'd been teaching about the dark underbelly of industrialized civilization for a long time. And you can't do that and live at the apex of empire and look at your face in the mirror for an extended period of time. I think there's a moral imperative to the way we conduct our lives. Living at the apex of empire doesn't match that moral imperative for me. In addition, I left as an act of resistance, consistent with my baby boomer generation, until we gave it all up for a few dollars more. So those are the two primary reasons I left the academy, to pursue a different way of life.
And when you do make decisions, I don't know, was it scary for you when you made that choice?
It was terrifying. It remains terrifying.
Okay, because I was scared to death when I resigned from LAPD. I mean, I had no idea what was going to happen, where I was going to go. I was giving up identity. Literally, it felt like my DNA was in that badge and the career that I'd worked for so long. And but what I found, looking back in hindsight, what has carried me consistently through was a sense of having to be absolutely true. I'm an only child. Maybe that has something to do with it. Absolutely true to something at the core of myself, knowing that if I compromised whatever that was at the core of myself, nothing else was ever going to taste good. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I had the brass ring. I'd reached the pinnacle of the educational world. I was a tenured full professor by the age of 40. My only brother, my only sister, my parents, lifelong academics. But walking away from that life, which I loved, was an act that made most people think I'd lost my mind. And it was a huge, huge threat to my identity. It's all I'd known my entire life.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes those leaps, I now tend to look back from my spiritual viewpoint as being initiations. Or evolutions, chosen evolutions, and I guess they're made all the better for not knowing what's going to result from it. You didn't see yourself doing this when you left the university, did you?
Well, in a way, I had prepared. I threw down a few bales of straw on the other side of the cliff to make for a softer landing. I share property. My wife and I share a small property with a small family of humans. And so we had been making arrangements to prepare for that soft landing for a couple of years before I left the university.
Ah, well, that's good. So what do you see on your immediate horizon? You've just finished your fourth speaking tour. You have a book. What's next? Are you writing? What?
Well, I continue to write both at Transition Voice and also on my own website. I have a paper coming out in a leading journal in my field, Conservation Biology. I'll continue to speak to anybody who will listen and to a lot of people who won't. And so I continue to try to line up events. I have one closer to you than to me in Oceanside, California, coming up the 2nd of June. And so I'll continue to try to keep doing that while also paying attention to what I'm doing here, where on this property we have ducks and chickens and,
mm-hmm.
and extensive gardens and orchards and so on. And that doesn't take care of itself. That needs some attention.
No, and I don't know about you, but I am so strongly feeling the call to be out there with my hands in the dirt and participating in all that right now. I'm not going to refuse it because I think there's something healthy in that too, something that maybe helps everything else change.
Well, absolutely. We have data now that indicates that if we spend time with our hands or our feet in the dirt, we're actually healthier than if we don't. So pushing all those electrons around on your screen isn't probably the healthiest lifestyle you can have.
Well, hopefully I think that might be ending soon. I have to tell you, quite frankly, it's, you know, I'll be happy when that happens because I have been tied to this Internet thing since 1998 when I started From the Wilderness, and I'll be eager to see the need for it go.
Absolutely. Absolutely, me too. It can't happen soon enough for me.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you had talked, I also watched some of the videos. You were up in New England somewhere, and I've talked about it on CollapseNet, and I've talked about it here. Methane vents in Siberia that you said... I think at one point were a meter across, and now they're a kilometer across and still expanding.
That's right. In 2010, climate scientists went to Siberia and found these methane vents that were a foot or so in diameter, and they lit them on fire, and there's a bunch of YouTube videos you can see on this. Mm-hmm. And by 2011, those vents had grown to being a kilometer in diameter, a kilometer across instead of a foot across. And nobody's lighting those on fire and showing them on YouTube.
What kind of volume are we talking about with vents, and how many vents? But, I mean, how much gas does that put in the atmosphere?
Well, I don't think anybody has got any sort of handle on it because it's just enormous. We've never attempted to measure something like that before. It's good to keep in mind that methane is about 25 times more powerful a greenhouse gas
right.
CO2. So it's hugely important, and it just, I mean, the news just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Every time I turn around, there's another bad bit of news about the consequences of industrialization.
Well, you know, clearly, and I reached the same conclusion from a different direction, but this beast has to be killed. It just has to be. We cannot sit by passively and expect it to die and wither on its own, and we're somehow going to ride out in a little island or a lifeboat someplace and not be touched of all of this. Unfortunately, in a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken's involved and the pig is committed, and what the universe is telling us now is that we all have to be pigs in one direction or another. But what the kind of action, I think, is a big question now for everybody. You have any ideas on that? What should we do? I mean, Occupy, I don't think, is coming back. What might make a difference?
Well, I think we need to... Well, there's a phrase that dates way, way back to walk away from the king. At this point, we have kings running the show, and we have capitulated to the kingdom. We have not had anything resembling a democratic process in this country, probably in this world, for a long time. So walking away is the first step, but it's completely inadequate. We need to destroy this system that is destroying us.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Jensen writes as well as anybody in the world about that, and so I would encourage people to start following his work, and in particular, the second volume of his book, Endgame, which is titled Resistance, is an amazing how-to guide to terminate the industrial economy.
Okay, well, that's okay. Now that's on my list, and of course we're watching that happen. Anything we can do to help its demise, we're all too happy to do. Guy McPherson, I want to thank you for joining us. So, GuyMcPherson.com. Your book again is Walking Away from Empire.
That's right. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight, Mike. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we're weaving like a really good web here, Guy, of some very enlightened and useful facets of consciousness with the people we're discovering. I mean, I hadn't become aware of you like until just recently, so I'm not sure when you started all this, but you were a breath of fresh air when I saw the clarity with which you spoke. And you seem to have coalesced all of the work that had been done underneath to you as a new platform, if you will, from reach another level higher on this ladder of evolution that we are clawing our way up.
I've been working on this for a long time. I was writing about global peak oil in 2002, 2003, and writing about climate change for 10, 15 years before that. But getting away from the university has given me more time to pursue those topics, more time to actually do research on the topics I'm interested in without having to suffer the adverse consequences associated with administrative dragons.
Living a good, healthy life feels good. That's an amazing discovery. Living right feels good. Living in connection with life and everything around us also does. Guy McPherson, thank you very much. I'm going to take a couple minutes. I want to talk to my listeners again before we wrap up the show. But keep up the good work, man, and thanks for coming on tonight.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, so Guy touched on something, and I really felt a need to tell a story because this has been very deeply in my mind. I'm going to close the show out with this. I started an earnest spiritual path, well, in 78, but I marked my real stepping across the threshold of universes and awarenesses in 1983 when I joined 12-step, which led me to a great many, many truths. We all, there are so many paths up the mountain, but the view from the top is still the same. That's a rock and roll song. I don't remember it, but somebody out there does. And one of the stories that I heard has to do with kind of describing where we are as a species on a planet right here at this moment. And the story was about an ancient Greek philosopher. Pick one. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, whoever. And as was the custom then with masters, as it is with masters teaching around the world. They had students of various levels and disciples who followed them closely. And one day this Greek master philosopher went to the student who had been with him the longest, the most loyal, the one who was like the leader right behind him, but it was still a young student. And he said, I'm going to take this whole day off, and I'm going to give it to just you, no other students. And on this day, I will teach you anything that you want to learn. And the student thought about it for a minute, and he looked at the master with these glowingly, you know, almond deer-shaped eyes and says, teach me about the truth. And the master took the student by the hand and walked him. They were on a beach in Greece, obviously, nice water. Walked him out in the water until they were about chest deep in the water. And the student was absolutely compliant. You know, all eyes, all ears open for anything. The slightest drop from his master's tongue of truth. And the master reached behind the student's neck and he pushed him, just under the water. And the student willingly obliged, and so the student was down underwater, and the master just gently holding his hand on the student's shoulder. But funny thing happened, after about 40 seconds or so, 45 seconds, the student started to run short of air. He wanted to breathe. And so he gently started to push up, but then the master pushed down harder, so the student, okay, so he wants me to gut it out. Okay. And so obviously this progressed until the student was overcome, was just trying to stand up because he was afraid he had to breathe. And the student was fighting now, but the master was holding him down with both hands and leaning on him and holding him underwater, so the student had to fight and kick and claw. And he had to claw, you know, hurt his master. But, you know, finally broke through the water, got this huge breath of air, of course, the look on his face was terror. He thought he'd screwed up. And the master looked at him, and he said, when you need the truth as badly as you needed that breath of air, you'll find it. That's where the human race is at this moment. There's going to be some changes in what I do at CollapseNet. I'm undertaking a major piece of writing, my first long essay in quite a while. And if you recall the old FTW days, I used to write some corkers. This one's going to be called Liberation. And it has a lot to do with this imperative, this crisis of consciousness, with this desperate search for the 100th monkey, which appears to be within our grasp. And I say that at the same time that I can look at all the events in the outer world and say how totally screwed we are, how totally fucked we are. I'll say that in honor of my friend Joe Rogan. I'm feeling the urge to talk to Joe Rogan again. And in spite of all that, that is the moment in time when we need our answers and we want our answers. And it is a pass-the-popcorn moment to find out whether we're going to get there or not. I love this show. You guys have been fabulous. PRN has been fabulous. We're having huge numbers tonight. The numbers are growing. That's another sign of the change of consciousness. We need your help at CollapseNet. We really do. And there are some people there at CollapseNet who have really put their hearts and all of their love into this, and we need some love back. And that's the way we're going to feed each other. Perhaps when we achieve a new vibration as human beings, we will find different kinds of currency. We will find a currency called honor, powered by an energy called love. We can hope. I'll see you next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Good night, everybody.